This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. For 7 years, readers of the Los Angeles Times have enjoyed the wit and insight of columnist Steve Lopez. In his Points West column, Lopez regularly eviscerates politicians, tells stories of ordinary Los Angelinos, and illuminates trends and issues in Southern California. But Lopez's encounter 3 years ago with a homeless street musician led not just to a column, but a life-changing friendship, a series of columns, a book, and a movie. Lopez has struggled to understand the mental illness that wrecked the promising music career and has tried to get his friend into treatment and off the streets. The film is now in production, with Robert Downey Jr. as Steve Lopez. Steve Lopez has written 3 novels and award-winning pieces for 4 newspapers and several national magazines. His new book is called The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Redemptive Power of Music. So, Steve Lopez, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, as a columnist in Los Angeles, I mean, I'm sure you've met lots of homeless people. What made Nathaniel Ayers particularly interesting to you?
I was walking through downtown Los Angeles, actually looking for something else, and spotted this gentleman, a little over 50 years old, playing a violin. And it's the violin, first of all, that made me turn my head. And then I noticed that he was wearing rags, and there was a shopping cart next to him. And as I got closer, I realized a couple of things. First of all, that the music was really pretty good and suggested there had been some formal training. And the other thing I noticed was that the violin had only 2 strings. So the natural first question is, hey, mister, that sounds pretty good, but are you aware that a violin has 4 strings? And I had to wait for him to break. He was very much involved in the piece that he was playing. I'm not sure what it was. And I knew very little about classical music. But what I heard, I thought, was quite beautiful. A little scratchy and maybe a little bit broken up. But the whole thing was just intriguing, and I wanted to know more. And I was thinking maybe there's a column in this guy's story, whatever it might be. So that's how it began, and I waited for that break, and I introduced myself. And I said it sounded pretty good, and he jumped back, frightened. And I tried to calm him a bit, but he was very skeptical, and what were my motives? And he didn't want to talk too much, and I just told him in that first encounter that I thought it sounded good, and maybe I'd come back and talk to him about it another time. It was clear that he was not comfortable with me. So I left, and I went back, and I kept it in mind as a possible column to return to, but that was the first contact.
And at some point you went and you noticed some names he had scrawled on the pavement next to where he was standing, and that's a fascinating little nugget, isn't it? Tell us the names and what they meant.
Okay, well, this was maybe the 4th, 5th, 6th visit. Okay. I can't remember. He had moved to another location. Another thing that intrigued me about that first location, though, I asked him when he warmed up a bit, why do you practice right here? And he pointed across the street and he said, because of that, because of the Beethoven statue. And I had never recognized a Beethoven statue in the middle of Pershing Square, which is a little park in the center of downtown Los Angeles. And I said, that's Beethoven. And he said, yes, somebody put it here. I don't know who did, but it was brilliant. It was inspired. And I come here to play near him so that I can keep an eye on him for inspiration. So then I spot him, I don't know if it's a couple of weeks later, maybe 3 weeks later, playing a few blocks from there. And by this time, he was not startled when I arrived on the scene. And he was down on his knees scrawling names on the sidewalk, I had noticed. And I asked, who are these names? It's, Betty and John and Sally and Robert, whatever the names were. And he said, oh, those were my classmates at Juilliard. It just stopped me. And I said, Juilliard? You mean the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts in New York City? And he said, yeah, in a very nonchalant way. And I said, you were a student there? And he said, oh, yeah, that was a long time ago. And I asked him a little bit about it, and he was quite modest about it, and it didn't seem like it was such a big deal to him. To me, it was. I ran back to my office, and I got on the phone to call Juilliard and see if indeed this guy playing a 2-string violin in downtown Los Angeles had been a student there. And I got a call from Juilliard the next day saying they did have a Nathaniel Anthony Ayers as a student at Juilliard in the late 60s and early 70s.
Maybe to give us a little bit more of a sense of what Nathaniel Ayers was like, because here's a guy who clearly had enormous musical talent and had been at the Juilliard School and had gone on a long, difficult journey since, and obviously was lucid in some respects. There's a moment at which you describe some of the monologues that he would, you know, he would deliver. Could you read a little bit of that for us?
Sure. And to give you a picture, Nathaniel, you know, his clothes are kind of soiled and rumpled, but there's some order to it, as if he's conscious of his appearance and is concerned about it. He would comb his hair and part it neatly. So he was trying to maintain some dignity, it seemed. And, you know, I didn't know what to make of what was going on in his head, but every once in a while he would say something that I'd just stand back and say, oh, wow. And, you know, here's one of the passages that might help illustrate that. Los Angeles is sloped downhill like a valley. Santa Monica Mountains, downtown Los Angeles, Honolulu. I haven't seen the ocean in Los Angeles. There's supposed to be an ocean, the Pacific. But this is not ocean terrain in the downtown area. You don't see the military statues like you have in Cleveland, where those are the leaders of the city and they have their army all over town with lots of horses. Cleveland Browns, Los Angeles Rams, those are armies too. Military regimentation, experimentation, with Mr. Roman Gabriel, the quarterback. Roman, Romans, Roman Empire, Colonel Sanders, Mr. Roman Gabriel designing a play in his dreams. Look, there go all the wide receivers down the street. This little guy here is the quarterback of the orchestra. This violin, which I purchased some years back at Modern's Music in Cleveland, Ohio. A cello can back this guy up with the same moves, but the cello is not the concertmaster. It's this youngster here that leads the way. Itzhak Perlman, Joshua Heifetz. They're like gods to me. I wish I had that talent. But if I practiced for the next 10,000 years, I could never be that good. In Cleveland, you cannot play music in winter because of the snow and ice, and that's why I prefer Los Angeles, the Beethoven city, where you have the sunshine, and if it rains, you can go into the tunnel and play to your heart's content. I am absolutely flabbergasted by that statue. It knocks me out that someone as great as Beethoven is the leader of Los Angeles. Do you have any idea who put him there?
Okay, so there's a little bit of a sense of what Nathaniel Ayers, the man who played the violin on two strings, sounded like at moments. So you wrote this column and got enormous reader reaction. Now, you've gotten enormous reader reaction before, and it could have been a story that ended there. Why didn't it?
Along with the reaction, I had the donation of instruments. I believe there were six violins donated after the first column. There was a cello donated. Later came another cello donation. A woman donated a piano, and I eagerly rushed out to the street to deliver some of them to Nathaniel, who could not believe this. I'm not sure that he really understood what was up. I mean, he connects in some ways and in other ways isn't sure what's going on. So I'm delivering these instruments to him, and he is gladly taking them off my hands, and I am struck by the problem I've created for myself. Here's a guy who lives on the streets of downtown Los Angeles, and as far as I could gather at that point, wandered over several blocks at night to sleep on Skid Row, which is an unbelievable place where a few thousand people at that time bedded down on the pavement every night, and there were some sick people and some scared people and some predators, and I was now handing over three violins and a cello to this guy, and I thought, he is going to get killed. So that's what got me beyond the first column, thinking, I've got to not just write about this guy, I've got to try to solve his problem. I've got to get him off the streets, or he's going to be beaten up for these instruments. So I tried to negotiate a deal in which I kept the instruments and delivered them to him by day so that he could play with them. And he just was not happy with that. And very early on, I got hold of a mental health agency, and they had come out and they took a look at him and they said, it's hard to talk somebody in who's resistant and has been out here this long. And I said, well, how about if you guys keep the instruments? And I'll tell him that if he wants to play the cello or the violin, he's got to go over to Lamp Community on Skid Row. And maybe that'll be a way to make the connection that gets him started going there. And maybe he can get the help that he needs.
Now he eventually showed up and played them there, but I gather managed to sneak away with them and then take them back with him to his life on the streets.
I thought he would never go, and I was just so frustrated, and I thought, well, maybe I've done all I can do for this guy. And then I got a call one day from somebody at Lamp saying, guess what? Guess who's giving a free concert in the courtyard at Lamp Community on San Julian Street? And I said, oh, my God, is he still there? I have to see this. And I raced over. And indeed, there he was. And he had a little audience, and he was playing. And I just felt so good to see that he was in a safe place where there were professionals who might give him some help. And I watched, and then I left. And I heard back later that when he left, he tried to steal the instruments. He tried to walk away with them, and somebody caught him. And the next time he went back, he pulled it off. He went, he played the instruments, and when nobody was looking, he left with, I think it was a violin and a cello. And now I really had a problem. I had a guy out on Skid Row with a brand new violin and a brand new cello. And this is a place where the sirens never stop. It's one of the highest crime areas in the city of Los Angeles. And there are some desperate people, and there are some sick people. And I was just worried sick. When my phone rang at night at home, I thought surely it was the police calling or the hospital saying there's some guy here who's beaten up pretty badly, and he says he knows you.
My guest is L.A. Times columnist Steve Lopez. His friendship with Nathaniel Ayers, a homeless street musician, is told in his new book, The Soloist. One of the interesting things that you did was to go and spend a night with him where he slept, which is not the tunnel where he played. Describe that experience.
Yes, in the evening he moved off of sort of the business district of downtown Los Angeles to Skid Row, and he stayed at a place that was very near a shelter where if he needed to use the bathroom or get a meal, he could go in there. And I thought, you know, I know him in a safe place by day. And I wonder what his life is like at night, and I need to spend a night with him. He thought this was the strangest thing that he'd ever heard, that this guy, this columnist, wanted to go and spend a night on the pavement with him. And what I saw that night was extraordinary. He first of all cleared a space on a street that had, as I recall, a few dozen people were going to camp out there for the night. And one of the interesting things that I was writing about here as I did follow-up columns is that this is about three blocks from City Hall in Los Angeles. It's about four or five blocks from a glittering skyline that looks like a profit chart. And here are all of these people, as if they've been shoved off into this human landfill, like a modern-day leper colony or something. And here I go to spend the night with him. And he begins by going to his spot. You know, some people with schizophrenia can be creatures of habit. And this was his spot, and this was his world, and he was sticking with it. And he would begin by crunching with his heel all of the cockroaches and scattering them, kicking them off into the curb. And then he would go through his shopping cart, which was just packed with all of these things, including the instruments. And I would often try to help him either load or unload the basket, and he would always tell me, please don't, I know where everything goes. I later learned, because I consulted with a psychiatrist by the name of Mark Reagans throughout this entire thing, that a schizophrenic can't control much. They're bombarded constantly with images, audio, and visual. They control what they can, and a shopping cart is something he could control. He can compartmentalize his life, and that's what he had. Everything set up the way he wanted, with him in control on that cart. So he takes out the cardboard, he puts it down on the pavement, he brings out the blankets, the pillows, and is setting up his bedding and gets his violin case, puts a blanket over that, that's going to be his pillow, and stands up on the curb and begins reciting Shakespeare. I had never heard this from him before, although with every visit, I was surprised all over again by this man. He's reciting the Hamlet soliloquy.
And how did his fellow Skid Row residents react?
They looked, and, you know, you see a little bit of everything on Skid Row, and they kind of shrugged it off, and, gee, he must be crazy. And it was this perfect, it sounded like Richard Burton had gotten up from this cardboard bed and is standing there with a great Shakespearean accent, and then gets back down on his bedding and looks up in the window and says, Mr. Lopez, do you think about writers the way I think about musicians? And I said, I do, Nathaniel. I do think about writers. I don't think that I'm as good a writer as you are a musician. And I like hearing you talk about it. And he looks up into a window and sees people living in these nearby buildings. And he said, you know, Beethoven was up in a window like that, and Mozart. They lived and breathed as we do. And he said, I'm just inspired to know that they created what they did. Do you find inspiration in that? He would say things to me like this that my jaw would drop, and the grace of this man and the humility. And one of the things that struck me was that there was never any expression of any regret. This was a man whose career was ascendant. He was 20-21 and through no fault of his own was struck down by this unlucky blow, and his career went off a cliff. And here he was, happy each day to find some time to play and content to be out here bedding down where he could look up into the windows and imagine a Beethoven symphony as he was falling asleep.
You know, one of the things that I know that you did was you managed to introduce him to some musicians from the Los Angeles Symphony. I mean, initially at a rehearsal, right? Was that a critical step for him?
It was indeed. You know, I had people were rooting for Nathaniel, and they were rooting for me to be able to help him and to figure out what I needed to do. And through this series of columns, people were staying in, you know, on top of the story, and I'd hear from them, what's the latest? Well, the latest was that somebody up at Disney Hall, the big concert hall in downtown Los Angeles, said, why don't you bring him to a concert? And I said, you know, when I first met Nathaniel, he was he had written on the side of his shopping cart, Little Walt Disney Concert Hall. And it would be great to get him to the big Walt Disney Concert Hall. But I don't know about this. I don't know about bringing him in his condition into a concert hall. I still am not sure what I'm going to get when I'm with him and what kind of behavior we can expect. So I got an idea, and I called Adam Crane, publicist with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and I said, Adam, by chance, do you think we could come to the rehearsal for that concert rather than to the concert? And Adam said, I don't see why not. So when I went to get Nathaniel on the big day, I thought maybe if I work through the music, that's the way to get to his mind and his soul. That's his passion. And if I can advance his recovery by bringing him back into the fraternity of musicians, maybe he'll feel differently. Maybe he'll one day want to have an apartment and get into a community orchestra or something. I didn't know what was possible, but I thought this is the logical next step. So on the day when I went to get him on Skid Row, my heart fell. He was in a foul mood. He was arguing and bickering. He was foul and belligerent, and he said he didn't want to go. And at this point, we're 6 months into this. And to be honest, I'm pretty tired, and the ups and downs are endless. And I said, Nathaniel, I think this is a great opportunity, but if you don't want to do it for yourself, will you do me a favor? I've invested a lot of time. Will you do this for me? And he looked at me, and he said, okay, let's go. On the way up the hill to Disney Hall, this is a trip of about 10 or 12 blocks. When Disney Hall comes into view, he begins to calm down. It was really an amazing thing to see. And we got close enough where he said, oh my God, it looks like an iron butterfly. And indeed it does. It's this Frank Gehry inspiration that, you know, looks like a schooner in full sail. And I said, you know, now that you've gotten me interested in classical music and you've been giving me an education, I'm going to be going in a couple of weeks to see Itzhak Perlman with the National Symphony. And he says, oh my God, Itzhak Perlman, he's molten lava on violin. And this is the man who 10 minutes earlier had been talking about cockroaches and greyhounds and using slurs and belligerent language. And now he's calming down, and we get up to Disney Hall, and he runs his hand across the performance board. And he looks at names like Beethoven and Mozart, and he looks like he's just in awe. And we go in and meet Mr. Crane, the publicist, and I still don't know what to expect. And Mr. Ayers, when he stepped into that hall, he said he probably hadn't been in a music hall for 10,000 years, but it felt good to be back in one. And he immediately struck up a conversation with Adam about composers, about conductors, about music. It was all way over my head. And I just kind of stood back like a proud parent. And Mr. Crane, the publicist, introduced him to a couple of musicians. One was a cellist by the name of Peter Snyder. Another was a cellist named Ben Hong. And Mr. Ayers spoke to them about music and about common acquaintances and things going all the way back to his days at Juilliard. And they were just delighted by this man. And they thought, he's so charming and he's so witty. And look at him. I mean, he clearly was a man of the streets. He said he had injured his right hand in a fight and it was wrapped in a rag. And so here was this raggedy guy who brought such refinement up to the hall. And they were all fascinated by him. And when they were done with the rehearsal, I realized that Nathaniel had had his violin with him the whole time, and it was so common that I didn't even take notice. And when the orchestra left the stage, Mr. Ayers opened the violin, and we walked up there behind the performance area, and he pulled it out, and he started to play. That moment was just one of the great moments of my career, of my life, to see this man who was back home.
Moving the story forward a bit, I mean, his reacquaintance with music through your introducing him to musicians progressed, and eventually he saw a full concert, and you introduced him to Yo-Yo Ma, and he had the thrill of being among musicians again. And you managed to get an apartment for him at this facility, the Lamp Community. But he wouldn't stay there for a long time, right?
Well, he was willing to. It was hard to get him in there, and again, I used little tricks. Peter Snyder, that cellist from the orchestra, agreed to give him lessons. And I said, Nathaniel, Mr. Snyder wants to give you lessons. Here's a great opportunity. And by this point, Lamp Community's mental health folks thought that he was advanced enough that he could move into an apartment. And this is an apartment in what's called permanent supportive housing. All of the services you need are there, psychiatric counseling and job training, and you get hooked up with your Social Security and all of that. And Nathaniel was resisting, didn't want a place to stay. And I said, well, here's the deal. Mr. Snyder needs a quiet place to conduct this lesson, and there's no room up at Disney Hall for him to do this. And he has asked if we could do this in your apartment. And he said, I don't have an apartment. And I said, yes, you have this space that they're holding for you. So that was how we got him in there finally. And we held the first lesson there. And Mr. Snyder was great. And he looked at him and heard him play and said, oh, my God, this guy. He said, I know of musicians who play that well, but not without years of training. And Nathaniel, when he was done with the lesson, said, okay, that's great, but I'm not staying in here. I prefer being in the tunnels. And Mr. Snyder said, well, why don't you think of this as your new tunnel? And Nathaniel just wasn't buying it. So it was still quite a while after that. And we got to where I was really concerned about his behavior seemed to be a problem. And he was taunting people, and I was worried that he was going to get into some trouble out there. And one night, I couldn't find him in his regular spot on the street. And I was desperate. I went out and drove around looking all over downtown for him, and had a fitful night's sleep, and woke up the next day and called Lamp to see if anybody had seen or heard from him. And Stuart Robinson, one of the directors there, said, yeah, he's right here. And I said, oh, my God, what a relief. You happen to know where he spent the night? Because he was not out on the street. And he said, yeah, I do know. He slept in the apartment.
And so for all this many, many weeks, he had had an apartment that they had been holding, but he had been carefully loading up his shopping cart and pushing it blocks and blocks every day back and forth because he wasn't ready to come in. And finally, he did, right?
Exactly. And, you know, there are these hurdles. There are these, you know, if you live on the street, one advantage is that you've got nothing to lose. And the idea of now having an apartment and now returning to the world in which he had cracked were probably psychologically too much for him to handle. And it took months for him to get up the courage and the comfort and the trust with all of the people who were telling him that he should do this to finally do it. It was a huge breakthrough when he did it. And I just threw my hands up. I wanted to run down and hug him and have a parade. And I went down to see him, and he said, it was fine. He said, you know, I really worried when I spent my first night there that I wouldn't be able to hear any noise. But he said, you know, I could hear the sirens all night. I could hear the helicopters, and the faucet was dripping. It was great.
And that was comforting to him, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the interesting things is that there was a period where he had this apartment at the Lamp Community but wasn't staying there. And it's a little odd because he almost had a status as, you know, a celebrity homeless person because he was, you know, you'd written so much about him in the columns and so many people were rooting for him. And I wondered if any of the other folks there who didn't have all this attention resented this and felt he was getting special treatment.
I think that the folks at LAMP were under a lot of pressure to explain themselves. And they also felt, I think, as though they were under pressure to make this philosophy work. they were the ones who had kept telling me, you know, he's going to come in. He's going to do it on his time. He's getting close. He's getting close. We were all rooting for him to move in. And yes, they had people on a waiting list. And here's this guy who, if he hadn't been in the paper, you know, probably would not have had an apartment held for him. And I had to define for myself, at what point am I a columnist? At what point am I using the column to the benefit of a friend? At what point am I putting the folks at LAMP in an uncomfortable situation? And are others not getting the same advantages? Those are moral quandaries that I never could quite work out. And what always motivated me, the rationalization I use, was this is an important story. We have discarded and abandoned people who are in need. If you had 2,000 people with pancreatic cancer, you would not push them all into this hole, out of the way, out of sight, out of mind in downtown Los Angeles or any other city. Why is it okay with mental illness? I was just wrestling with all of these things and not sure what the right answers were, but I knew at this point that I cared deeply about this man and was going to do whatever I could to help him.
At one point, one of the other residents in this LAMP community, people who had, you know, many of them schizophrenia and many of them who had been homeless, came to you and said in a very tough and challenging way, when are you going to tell the real story? When are you going to write the real story about your friend Nathaniel? What did he mean?
What he meant was that Nathaniel was not always, as I have said, the refined, genteel man of music and poetry. There was always lurking just beneath the surface this other guy who lives inside of him. And it's an angry, resentful, paranoid guy who thinks that people are stealing things from him and who thinks that they're out to get him, and that he's got to defend himself. And what that translates into is some very aggressive, interaction with people. It might be telling them that he's not putting up with their nonsense, and it might be with veins bulging and eyes just rage coming up in him. And it can be very intimidating.
And you had one terrible experience with him yourself, and this was when you got to know his family a bit, his sister, who you connected with, and there came to be a legal issue, right, where you wanted to have her have some legal authority. And he regarded this with the sort of paranoid rage that you had seen in others, and you had this really disturbing exchange. If you could describe that.
His sister, Jennifer, from Atlanta, was coming to Los Angeles for a court hearing at which she was going to be named his conservator to handle his financial matters. And I had to notify him that there was a court appearance scheduled, and he said okay. And I handed him the papers, and I told him that he didn't have to appear, but that she would be appearing in his behalf. And he had said that he was okay with this. He didn't want to manage any money that he got, you know, from a movie or a book or anything else. He wasn't interested in it. He had no material needs, and could his sister please handle it? Okay, well, that involves coming and having the court declare that she's in charge. And so I delivered those papers, and the next time I went to see him to tell him that Jennifer was about ready to arrive in Los Angeles, I went to the courtyard, the very place where he first played music, and Nathaniel ignored me when I got there. And I called out to him. He was playing a trumpet. I had bought him a trumpet that I bought on Craigslist. He told me he needed to try out the horn. And he started to walk down those stairs, and he looked at me, and we're maybe 20 feet away, and he shook the trumpet at me. And it came up in him again, this rage. And he started screaming at me, saying that he wasn't going to court, nobody was going to make him go to court, and he was not going to be locked up again. And I said, you don't have to go to court. Nobody's going to lock you up. This is not about that. But he's been locked up. He's been in handcuffs. He's been in jail. He's had shock treatment. And part of the resistance to medical attention now is that he fears that he's being duped. And that's what we're going to do with him. We're going to put him in a straitjacket and you know, put the do the shock therapy again or whatever, or zap him with Thorazine. And I said, no, no, it's not like that, Mr. Ayers. We are not going to force you to do anything. She's just coming to town to help out. She's coming so that you don't have to worry about looking at contracts or any of this other stuff. She's going to manage your affairs. And he wasn't buying it. He thought that this whole thing had been a plot for me to get him arrested and dragged off to a hospital or a jail. And he shook that trumpet at me and threatened me. He threatened my life. He said that if he ever saw me again, that I would be reduced to a pool of blood. He screamed at me. He told me to please leave. He yelled as I walked away, and he told me that he never wanted to see me again. That was about the worst that it ever was. We've had a few of these. That was the worst.
You looked into Nathaniel Ayer's background, and he grew up in Cleveland and was obviously a gifted musician. He came from a broken home. But his psychotic break when he made it to New York to study at Juilliard, as best you can tell, what happened?
In his second year at Juilliard, he began to have trouble focusing. As I look back at his transcripts, he did best in classes where he was expected to perform. In other words, in the orchestra class, he got A's, and his judges said that he was a promising, brilliant young musician. If he had to sit and listen to something about music theory, the grades went from B's to C's to D's to incompletes. And nobody knew at the time what was going on, he just struggled a bit. And when he went back for the start of his third year at Juilliard, it all just came apart. He was hearing voices. He was having more difficulty getting by in class. Amazingly, he still performed extremely well when he had the instrument in his hands. But one night, he was in the apartment of a colleague, another student, and began taking his clothes off, and the classmate said, "What are you doing?" And Nathaniel didn't have a coherent answer and didn't seem to know what he was doing. His classmate called 911, and they took him away to Bellevue.
That's the public hospital in New York, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, he snapped, and he was soon thereafter diagnosed with schizophrenia, and dropped out of school, went back home. Spent many years in treatment. He lived with his mother, who was the real saint in this story. She took him and dealt with all of the difficult times, kept taking him back in, even when he would get aggressive and violent. And she had him seeing a doctor. He's had some treatment. He was in shock therapy. He was on medication. He always, though, fell off and would end up wandering. And when she died, he moved to Los Angeles. He got on a bus, and he came west knowing that his father had lived here. Unfortunately, when he got here, his father was already gone, had moved to Las Vegas. So Nathaniel stayed with a relative a while and then began wandering the streets sometime, I can't tell, 2001, 2002, somewhere around there, and had been pretty much hanging out on the streets of downtown L.A. until that day I met him.
Well, Nathaniel Ayers eventually did manage to come inside. But at least as you finished the book, he was still refusing medication and wouldn't really see doctors about his schizophrenia. Is that where he is still? Do you ever see him seeking treatment for his mental illness?
I have hopes that he will. There are still these signs of slow, steady progress. Recovery, as I learned, is not linear. You have good days and bad. But he does have a little music studio, and he likes to go in there and play music. He called me this morning. It's the 7 a.m. call that I get. And he said, Mr. Lopez, Mr. Crane up at the L.A. Philharmonic said that maybe we could do a recording session. He's got Robert Gupta, a violinist in the orchestra, as a friend of his, and a pianist thought that maybe they could play together. And, we go to ball games, we go to concerts, and he goes to his music studio. And his goal, he says, is to be a music therapist, to use music to help other folks. He's not there yet. He's got a ways to go. I do have this hope, this dream, that one day he gets well enough to give medication a try. I do know, however, that that's no panacea, that it's difficult to find the right medication. And even if you do, with this new generation of antipsychotic meds, it's not necessarily the answer. He might get so well that he says, "Hey, I'm feeling fine. I don't need these." And you're right back where you started. The thing that I tell myself, though, is that he's in better shape than he was when I met him, and so am I. I was so inspired by him and by the work that's being done on Skid Row that I thought about getting out of my dying newspaper business and trying to start a second career. He inspired that just because of his courage, because of his patience, I thought, I'm going to do this. I was prepared to take another job. What I decided in the end is that one of the many gifts I've gotten from Nathaniel, and this has always been a two-way street, it's not just me doing for him. There's this humility, there's this good feeling I have from giving something. I was never the big brother type. And now here I am with this relationship where I've really meant something to him, and he has to me. And thinking about his passion made me realize that it was that music that got him through all of these troubles. You know, the world is always spinning wildly for him, but the music has not moved. The notes are in the same place on the page. They've been there for two centuries, and he loves that music. He loves how it balances him. And I thought, for me, the passion is words. The passion is the privilege of writing about people like him. And he has re-sparked my interest in what I do for a living. I cannot leave this. That's one of Nathaniel's gifts to me. I'm recommitted to what I do for a living, and I might be the last one out of the building, even as the whole thing is going under.
You mentioned a moment ago that he called you at 7 a.m. Does he call you every day?
Most days I get a 7 a.m. call, and I get a 6 p.m. call. And it begins, "Good morning, Mr. Lopez. How is Allison, Mrs. Lopez? How are Jeffrey and Andrew Lopez? How is Caroline Lopez? I had a breakthrough last night, Mr. Lopez. You are not going to believe what happened on the Elgar Cello Concerto. I don't know how it came to me. There must have been a spirit in the room. I was practicing, and all of a sudden, the music made sense. And Jacqueline Dupre and Janice Starker and even Yo-Yo Ma are going to have to step aside." These are the kinds of conversations we have. And Mr. Lopez, are we going to the Dodger game this Tuesday, or was that next Thursday? Every day we're in contact and see each other a couple times a week.
Your book, The Soloist, is now a movie in production with Jamie Foxx playing Nathaniel Ayers, and you're being portrayed by Robert Downey Jr. Does Mr. Ayers, is he aware of this? Does he have any role here?
He's very much aware, and he's not particularly interested in my book, although he's read it. And he said, "Hey, congratulations. I hope you win an award for it," he said. The movie, he's interested more in the fact that the people associated with the movie, from Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey to the crew, are curious about him and like seeing him and like hearing him play. So for him, this is an opportunity to have a new audience, and he's been invited over to play for the crew on occasion, and that part he likes. A couple of weeks ago, they shot the scene at Disney Hall, which was our first visit, and I said, "Mr. Ayers, we got to go. It's going to be Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey sitting in the very seats that we sat in, and the LA Philharmonic plays itself in this movie, and he knows half the orchestra now and has friends there and teachers there." And I thought this would be such a great day for him to drop by the set of the film, which is almost done as I speak. And he said, "I'll meet you there." So I get to Disney Hall. He is set up across the street. He's got a brown folding chair. He's sitting on that. He's got his cello out, and he's playing. And I go over and I say, "Mr. Ayers," we address each other, Mr. Lopez and Mr. Ayers. He once yelled at me for calling him Nathaniel, while he always referred to me as Mr. Lopez, and ever since then I've called him Mr. Ayers. It sounds strange to people, Mr. Ayers, Mr. Lopez. But I said, "They're doing the scene, the big scene. Come on, we've got to go inside and watch this." And he said, and he looked up at the sky, beautiful blue sky, nice day, sunny. He said, "I just started playing this thing, and it's really going well, and I think I'd rather play." And I said, "Mr. Ayers, this is the big scene. This was our breakthrough day. They're shooting our first day in Disney Hall. Don't you want to see that?" He said, "Yeah, well, you know, I do, but I've really got something going here. I think I'm going to stay and play this just a little bit longer." So I cross the street, climb the stairs at Disney Hall. I look across, and there he is, sawing away, as he calls it. And inside this building, maybe 300 people, the LA Philharmonic, the cast, the crew, are shooting a film about his life. And I said to the producer, Gary Foster, "You know what, Gary? We picked the right name for this thing, The Soloist. There he is."
Well, Steve Lopez, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
LA Times columnist Steve Lopez's new book is The Soloist. We used to talk about making somebody a scapegoat or throwing them to the wolves. Now we're more likely to talk about throwing them under the bus. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been tracking the phrase that's become the linguistic megastar of this year's political season.
To judge from appearances, the presidential candidates have been spending half their time explaining away their own mistakes, and the other half repudiating the things said and done by their supporters and friends. So it's no wonder the phrase under the bus has appeared in more than 400 press stories on the campaign over the last 6 months. Under the bus is where Hillary was described as throwing her chief strategist Mark Penn, and where the radio talk show host Bill Cunningham said that John McCain had thrown him after McCain disavowed Cunningham's reference to Barack Hussein Obama at a McCain rally. And after Obama's speech on race, under the bus is where he was accused of throwing his grandmother by Ann Coulter, Fred Barnes, and Karl Rove, not to mention well over 100 other conservative columnists and bloggers. That piling on might suggest a certain lack of originality, but it takes a lot of self-restraint to pass up on an opportunity to charge a politician you don't like with throwing his grandmother under a bus, even if it's only in a manner of speaking. That helps to explain why throw somebody under the bus has shot so quickly from new kid on the block to the idiom A-list. The word sleuth Grant Barrett has traced it back as early as 1991, but its origins are lost in the mists of the 1980s. Some people suggest it's derived from a phrase for a washed-up rock star on tour, and others connect it to the announcement made by a minor league baseball manager, bus leaving, be on it or under it. There's no evidence for either origin, but we always assume that there has to be some real-life scenario behind each of these metaphors, however far-fetched it is. And the internet and bookstore shelves are teeming with treasure troves of word lore that are eager to oblige us with ingenious speculations. As in, see, back in Elizabethan times, the household pets used to curl up in the thatched roofs to keep warm until they were washed out by a downpour. You hear a lot of talk these days about the wisdom of crowds, but when it comes to the crunch, we're reluctant to credit the collective mind with the same creative imagination that we accord to an individual artist's. It's as if we expected Bob Dylan to be able to point to the event that inspired every line in his songs. So then I wet my finger and I stuck it in the air and I said... Actually, it's my guess that somebody just pulled throw under the bus out of the ether one day, and other people picked it up and passed it along. It's what marketers like to describe as a viral process, except that these aren't exactly like the unaccountable fads that can instantaneously populate every kindergarten class with Ethans and Emmas. The geography of betrayal was already mapped out pretty thoroughly in English. You can hang somebody out to dry, throw him to the wolves, let him twist in the wind, sell him down the river, offer him up as a scapegoat, or make him a fall guy, a patsy, or a sacrificial lamb. So throw under the bus wouldn't have caught on unless it suggested a compelling new take on some familiar perfidies. Or probably I should say new takes, since the expression seems to conjure up different things for different people. Some people like to think of the thrower and throwee as fellow passengers on a team bus or tour bus. That would explain why we talk about the bus rather than a bus, and it foregrounds the idea of a betrayal. But it makes the action a little hard to picture, since you have to imagine one rider on a moving bus managing to throw another rider under its wheels, which seems like a stunt from a Steven Seagal movie. So evidently a lot of people just picture the victim being pushed off a curb in front of an oncoming Greyhound. But one way or the other, the expression conveys a singularly modern image of stop-at-nothing ruthlessness. These things work like little film clips. You hear he made her take the fall, you flash on the Maltese Falcon. You hear he threw her under the bus and you envision some more recent movie. I don't know exactly how the plot goes, but it probably features Javier Bardem. We have more exacting standards in mayhem these days, whether in our movies or our metaphors. There was a time when the emblematic moment of movie sadism was Jimmy Cagney shoving a half grapefruit into Mae Clark's face in The Public Enemy. And when people could still get a vicarious tingle out of saying that so-and-so got worked over or got the living daylights beat out of him. But those expressions seem pretty demure for the age of Hannibal Lecter and Anton Chigurh's cattle gun. The verbal violence that we get off on is a little more graphic, which is why Google reports 250,000 hits for people talking about tearing somebody a new one. I have some trouble imagining Cagney using that phrase, probably for the same reason it's hard to picture Sam Spade telling Bridget O'Shaughnessy, "Angel, I'm throwing you under the bus." That's not a judgment, mind you. but every age seems to get the idioms it needs.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.